Welcome to Roots and Ruminants, your podcast for creative and innovative use of farm, pasture, and rangeland. We're going back to the basics of raising and grazing livestock, growing your own forage, and practical land use. Well, welcome back to another episode of Roots and Ruminants. Jared Nock here with my co-host Justin Frichte, and today we have the pleasure of AJ Munger from Eagle Pass Ranch in Highmoor, South Dakota, joining us today to talk a little bit about their operation, what they do, some things that they've changed over the last few years, and then also just probably some broader perspective on the beef industry as a whole. So, AJ, welcome to Roots and Ruminants.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Yeah. So, start us off, we'd like to have everybody kind of go through a little bit of their background. How was it that you ended up joining us from Eagle Pass Ranch, right east of Highmoor, South Dakota? What's that journey look like, and how did you get to where you're sitting at today?
Well, I would be second generation. My dad, back in the 80s, was a commodities broker in Dallas, Texas. And there was a group of guys that were kind of hard to work with. And his boss said, if you're willing to put up with them, then you can have them as clients. And so he took it over and took the account over. And they were doing some tax shelter cattle feeding down in Eagle Pass, Texas. And did that for a few years. Most of these guys were from out in New York. And then the loophole ended up getting closed in the mid 80s. And so they were looking for other opportunities. And this ranch was for sale at the time. It's the old Jennings Highland Angus Ranch. And the Travelers Insurance Company had owned it at the time. And that was when corporations couldn't own land for more than 3 years. And I actually don't know if that's still the rules or not. But anyways, this was in year two. And so they made him an offer on the ranch and they turned it down. So ended up leasing it for a year. And then after the next year, they still didn't have any other offers. And so they ended up accepting the offer from this group. And so Dad was always the managing partner. And then over the years, as guys wanted bought out, they would, sell some land, take on some debt and buy those guys out. And then in 2016, the last partner ended up passing away. And so we were able to purchase his partnership from the estate. So now it's my brother and my dad and I. My brother came back to the ranch right out of college, went to SDSU, came back and started working on the cattle side and worked his way up to cowherd manager. I took a little bit different path, came back and worked at, we have a hunting lodge too. And so I managed the hunting lodge for a couple of years and then met my wife and we moved out to New Jersey for a few years while she was finishing up school. Worked for a company called Erner Berry, which is a market reporting company. And so I reported the wholesale box beef markets, which was really interesting job. That was a whole new side of the business that I didn't know anything about. And so I went into it completely green and still, probably only understand, a little bit of everything that goes on behind the scenes. But that was a great experience. And then I got an offer to come back to South Dakota and be the sales and marketing director at the beef plant, formerly known as Northern Beef Packers. So I was there for 8 months or so until we ended up closing and filing for bankruptcy. And that was tremendous experience too. It was not how I saw things going and, probably jumped into things a little prematurely, just, with the chance to come back home to South Dakota and, work in a position that I was really interested in. And so after that, I I had the opportunity to come back and work at the ranch and in sales and marketing, and did that for a few years. And then, it was really at the same time that, we ended up purchasing the whole ranch. My brother moved to the farming side, and that allowed me to move into the cowherd manager. And so that's kind of how it's set up today. I manage the cowherd and cattle operations, and my brother manages the farming operations. And so we work pretty closely together. We raise all our own feed, and so we're in constant discussion about that. And then dad's still part of the operation, not as much in the day-to-day anymore, but definitely still in the yeah. scheme of the overall business. But that's where we're at.
That's fascinating. It's always very much appreciate that rich backstory, because it's always kind of makes you think, like, how did it come about that I'm sitting in this spot right here, right now, today? Like, well, what does that look like, you know? So that's fantastic. So, yeah, like a 35, multi-decade journey between, starting out with partners and then eventually, kind of getting back to that sole proprietor, ownership. And so your dad grew up in kind of up towards Aberdeen, right? Warner, South Dakota. Is that correct?
Yep. I went to high school in Warner. My mom and dad lived on our home quarter up until COVID. And then at that point, they decided to move down to the ranch because they never did make the move, because it was never meant to be a long-term investment. It was more of a land speculation. And then the land prices didn't appreciate as quick as they had hoped. And then they bought registered cattle, and we're stuck with it. So, it's been good, and it's a tremendous opportunity, we love it, and mom and dad now live at the ranch. I used to, when I first moved back to work at the packing plant, we lived up by Aberdeen. My wife was a pastor up by Columbia, and then we ended up moving to Pierre in 2017, and so then I drove back and forth between the ranch and Pierre. Mm-hmm. And then just this last year, we ended up moving to the ranch. So our whole family's here now, mom and dad, and Nate's always been here. And my wife and I just joined the ranch community here this last summer. So it's good having everybody here in close proximity.
Yep. No, it's fantastic. Go ahead, Justin.
So I had read through the history that you've got written out on your website. So it's actually written very well. So if anybody wants the whole backstory of the Jennings Highland Angus was the original ranch, right?
Right.
And so I'm reading through this, right? And then how did Les and Lee Leachman get into it? There was some sort of partnership between them at some point too.
Yeah. It's a very history rich ranch, basically. Yeah. Jennings Brothers came up in the 30s when everybody was kind of out on their luck, and they were hog merchants from Iowa. And so they came up here and they had cash in their pocket. And Clayton wrote three books. It goes into in-depth about their story. But yeah, basically came up here. They were in the right place at the right time. And started putting ranches together, and after a while it amassed a pretty large block of land here in central South Dakota. And then Leachman's came in the 60s, some of that history kind of all blends together, and I don't necessarily follow all the timelines, but Leachman's were here. They came out from New York, and then left for Montana, and then Lee ended up in Colorado. They were here, and then Ankeny was here as well. And I don't know exactly how long they were here. I went to Nebraska, I think, after they left here, and now they're in Georgia.
Georgia. Definitely. Yeah. I think for now, maybe they moved again. I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I might jump ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm kind of jumping ahead to where we'll probably get eventually further into this conversation. But to think about the type of cattle that they're raising back then, the type of cattle that you're raising now, and how breeding strategies fit into it to fit the environment, does it really matter? I mean, there have been so many different types of cattle grazed those prairies that you're at on the ranch, and it's probably worked about any way with the different philosophy that each breeders have. Do you think that's true, or is not necessarily?
Well, my dad likes to say that so far we're the only owners that haven't gone bankrupt running this ranch. So.
All right.
Sure.
Now it's answered, maybe.
That's a good point. What's your definition of it's always worked, right? There was always cows around, right?
The cows were grazing. That part worked.
Yeah. Weren't always paid for, didn't always make money, you know, didn't always have a clear ownership pathway. That's a fair point.
Perfect
fair
answer. Point. Yeah. Oh, gosh.
But it is kind of fascinating. You think like some of these purebred operations that move state to state to state. But you think about the types of cattle, you know, from the Continental boom, from belt buckle Angus in the Highland, the Ankeny days in the 60s to, you know, the Continental boom. I mean, all those types would have come through the ranch, right?
Yeah,
over those years, you know? So tell us about what the strategy is today on how are you making cows that are particularly adapted to the Northern Plains and beyond, but in the Northern Plains today. What's the strategy behind selection that you use today, AJ?
So I would say, you know, since coming back to the ranch in 2013, I've been moving towards more of a low input strategy, for years and years and years. I mean, it's still, you know, probably the way that 90-some% of seed stock producers, market bulls and raise bulls are, a high management, high input strategy. And so I thought that was not necessarily matching up with our customers and what their needs were. And so that's when, you know, we started switching gears, and it's been a gradual transition. It's never worked really well to make a real abrupt change in the seed stock business, and so we wanted to kind of do it gradually and bring our customers along with it. But really, it started with getting involved with NRCS and some equip projects. I'm doing some cross fencing, water infrastructure development, and that kind of opened our eyes to what might be possible. And so that's it's kind of taken us down a rabbit hole. And here we are now, calving in May, winter grazing on crop aftermath, and it looks a lot different than it did, even 5-10 years ago. So,
yeah.
That's kind of where we see things going. And, you know, I think my dad kind of, started it all with, he realized that one of the biggest costs of cow-calf production was feed costs. And so, he was one of the early adopters for testing for feed intake and identifying animals that were, more feed efficient. And so, I think that set the course for where we are today. We continue to find ways to, not necessarily grow the top line, but keep the top line revenue the same, but continue to find ways to eliminate that costs and overhead.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And so when you talk about that shift, I mean, like I said, a lot of your contemporaries in the seed stock world are trying to figure out how do we calve a little bit earlier, run a bull sale earlier, and so pretty soon a lot of your peers are calving at Christmas time, right? Some are half done by the end of January or more, right? Mm-hmm. And when you say like calving in May, we kind of calve in May too, I say, but really we'll have a big chunk in April. I've been fortunate enough to help you out in several AI projects over the years at the ranch. We bred a set of cows for you guys, with you guys, the week of the state fair, right? The 25th of August. You are truly like calving in, you know, the front part of summer there, the absolute end of spring, right?
Right. Yep. Yeah. We've always, you know, thought, you know, May 10th is kind of the day that we, can go to grass, and then May 10th rolls around and it seems like, you know, we've had a cold spring or a dry spring, and we just, you know, don't have the grass ready to go. And it's really not until like the end of May that we're really comfortable with, you know, turning cows out. And so, yeah, we don't feel real rushed to, you know, have calves on the ground in April. We really want to try and match up that peak lactation period with our peak forage time. And for us, that's, you know, the last week in May through the end of June.
That's great.
How have your genetics shifted with the change? I mean, as far as breeds and, you know, just the type of the cow that you're making now.
Sure. So yeah, that's, that looks a lot different now too. When dad, first bought the ranch, they bought 4,500 commercial cows and, AI'd them all to Gelvie bulls. And they did that for like 10 years and they only kept the cows that bred AI. And, you know, as far as I know, it's one of the largest breed up projects in, you know, the history of the business. And, I still don't know how they accomplish it. I mean, we bred, you know, 1300 this year and I thought that that was plenty.
But, with the tools of modern synchronization and cedars and all that kind of stuff, right? No, this is all like ride and heat detect, and you had Lutalyse that was your tool, you know?
Yep. So then we, I guess I say we, but dad bought some Angus cows from Jorgensen's and Baldridge's back in the early 90s, and then, you know, took some of those Gelvie females and bulls and started mating them to Angus bulls and Angus females. And we were really one of the first ones to start making hybrids in the 90s. You know, I think that was a result of, you know, dad saw what those, what that F1 cross looked like on the Gelvie bulls on the commercial cows. And, you know, I think ever since then, he's huge proponent of crossbreeding. And so, I think we were really one of the first ones that were, you know, doing the hybrid deal in the 90s and, made a big push in the, you know, Gelvie Association at that time to get, the herd book open so that, balancers could be registered and run with you know, the Gelvie animals in the database. That was hard. We just about got run out of the breed association. There's you know, a lot of guys that, you know, really thought that we were undermining the breed by you know, introducing Angus genetics. But that was really a big part of our program. And I would say, you know, by 2010 we were probably 75% to 80% hybrid. And still selling a few purebred Angus and purebred Gelvies. In 2013, we ended up dispersing the Angus herd. And then it was also about that same time that we started using more Simmental and some Angus sires. So we took you know, some of those Angus cows and bred with the Simmental bulls to kind of start the foundation for what's our Sim Angus herd now. And so, yeah, fast forward to 2020, we dispersed the balancers and Gelvies, and now we are predominantly Sim Angus. We still use some balancer bulls in our breeding program to make some composites that are, you know, Gelvie Simmental Angus cross. We don't have a lot of purebreds. We've got just a handful of purebred Angus and a handful of purebred Simmental, but yeah, I would say, you know, like this year's bull sale, 90% of our offering will be, you know, hybrid bulls that are either Simmental Angus cross or Simmental Gelvie Angus cross.
How is the feed efficiency? So take us back to how many years have you guys been doing individual intake feed efficiency measurements?
2007 was the first year that we started testing animals. And, you know, every year I'd say we test 400 to 500 head of bulls and replacement females. We've also done some, we've tested some steers. We've tested some wet 2 year olds that we had also tested as replacement heifers to see how they ranked compared to when they were tested as calves. So yeah, we've tested, I think over last count, 6,500 head through our feed efficiency system. Yeah.
And how has that changed? I've seen this in the, you know, maybe the sale catalog in years past, but how has that changed from, you know, the records that you're keeping, the actual feed efficiency, that you're recording, you know, the phenotypic data, how has that changed over that course of time?
So, initially, we didn't have the capability to do any type of genetic evaluation, and so it was primarily just, you know, running sire averages on the pen on the contemporary group, and, you know, that's how we would compare across contemporary groups is, you know, basically how the sire is indexed. Until we got enough information, and now we can run a genetic evaluation. There's a lot of different ways to measure feed efficiency, and I don't know if, you know, anybody's come up with, the perfect way to do it. I've got my own, thoughts on it, but, you know, really the three main ways of measuring feed efficiency, feed to gain, which is, you know, something that most everybody's, familiar with. And then, two other measures called, residual feed intake or RFI and residual average daily gain, which is RADG. So Vitelli, which was formerly GrowSafe, were big proponents of RFI. It's been something that's been around for a long time. I think really since the 60s is when it first started showing up in the research. And, you know, basically what it measures is what is an animal's intake above or below what was expected of that animal based on its contemporary's performance on test. And so a negative number would be more preferable. You know, a minus one would be that animal consumed 1 pound less than what we would expect based on the feed consumed by the other animals on test and its growth rate. And then I guess residual average daily gain would be slightly different. It would measure the gain difference above or below what was expected of that animal on test based on the amount of feed that was consumed. So Angus Association publishes their residual average daily gain. There's a few different breed associations that, you know, just measure a DMI, dry matter intake, and then there's some breed associations that will produce a RFI EPD. But the RFI EPD that we use is generated by Vitelli. They have feed intake systems all over the country, you know, various ranches and university stations. So they take all that information and compile it into a genetic evaluation. And it's getting to be fairly robust. I think last time I heard there was over 100,000 animals in the genetic evaluation. So that's it's becoming a pretty powerful database.
Yeah, and for the listeners, I mean, so just to follow along with why there's those different designations, you know, ultimately we want two things. We want gain and we want, you know, feed to gain, right? Ratios to be in line. The problem with just using a feed to gain ratio is that you can end up with a very efficient, slow gaining animal, one that doesn't eat hardly anything, but doesn't grow very much either, right? So to avoid those kind of situations where you artificially select for reduced intake and reduced growth, you need to have these more complex arrangements where you're trying to like analyze and make sure that you're not weighting a low intake animal too high when it comes to that. Now, low intake animals, as we've been able to look at them as they enter in the cow herd. Any you know, consideration or any kind of theories on can you reduce select for reduced intake on a feeder calf from that data and extrapolate that into a lower maintenance cow? What's your experience been there?
Yeah, I do think so. You know, one of the issues is that, you know, the change is incremental and very gradual. You know, and so it's hard to compare, you know, where we're at now to where we were in 2007, 2008, when we first started testing. But if we go back and look at the data, you know, it shows that we've been able to increase the feed efficiency in our cow herd by over 25%. So, I mean, there is definitely some significant movement of the needle there. But yeah, I guess I haven't gone back and looked, and I don't even know if we have those records, you know, with, you know, with how much hay and silage we fed, you know, back in 2007, 2008 for where we're at now. But I really would at some point like to come up with, you know, kind of a cow cost index, and you know, maybe something that we could publish in our catalog, because you know, it's just really something that we don't talk enough about in the industry. And you know, I think that's probably more impressive you know, than weaning weights or post weaning gain or you know, any of that. Is, you know, tell me what your cow costs look like, tell me what your, you know, what that trend is over the last 5 or 10 years. Is cow costs going up every year, or are they staying the same, or are you able to, you know, do some things through management genetics to bring those cow costs down? And I would say our cow costs are dramatically cheaper than where they were, you know, 5 or 10 years ago.
Yeah, switching to the just your calving date, right, and matching that cow's nutritional requirements at the stage of lactation and gestation and getting pregnant, it all matches with the timing of the forage being available. Much better than, you know, calving in January, February anyways. But the other thing that I think you mentioned this, right, your cow costs and relating that to feed efficiency, your cow intake and her efficiency on roughage is much different than a feeder calf's efficiency on a high grain, high starch diet. And I think sometimes those like feed efficiency trials can be very antagonistic against maintenance of a cow, right? And that because a cow being this like you picture like an old school Angus who's really moderate frame, deep sided, big volumed, and can just, you know, digest a bunch of low or high fiber, low starch rations. That's way different than a limousine calf who is shallow bodied, full of muscle, but can eat a bunch of corn and gain really, really fast. And so I think like thinking through how you're putting feed efficiency tests on and relating to that to your cow costs, I mean, they're kind of different things, or could be different things, I guess.
No, I think you're exactly right. And, you know, I think that's probably the thing that we've learned through all of this is that the more we learn about feed efficiency, the more that we realize that there's still a lot more to understand about how best to select for it in different situations. And I think, you know, what you were talking about, Justin, was, you know, I think that aligns with, you know, my thoughts on feed efficiency too, is that I really think it needs to be, you know, dry matter intake as a EPD included in a bioeconomic index, because, you know, with that bioeconomic index, then you can, you know, weight those differently for, you know, a cow-calf operation or for a feeder calf, or, you know, for a terminal versus a cow herd that keeps its own replacements. You can really design those indexes, you know, however you'd like, with intake being part of the equation. But, you know, for a long time, we just didn't have any intake data, and we still don't have a lot of intake data because it's very expensive to get. And that's really been the biggest limiting factor, is just the expense and lack of intake data out there. But I do think that we're, you know, continuing to make strides, and we'll get there now that, you know, we're starting to incorporate some genomics and we're not too far away, I think, from really getting a better grasp on, you know, what intake means in different situations.
Yeah. Well, so I do think that there is a divergence in this, almost getting to be such a divergence. One, we have better ways to collect data and actually analyze and sort it. And there's been a bit of a divergence, because if you're a January, February calf or calf fed program, what you're selecting for in feed efficiency is totally different than a late calving yearling program, right? And so I've been around these debates since, you know, I probably first BIF meeting I went to is probably 2007 when I started working at Transova. So I've been a part of these. That was right at the time when people were getting the big argument of how we're going to, you know, look at feed intake, or how we're going to look at feed efficiency, what index are we going to use, what methodology. And it's always been like, there's one way, and we all have to agree on one way to look at it. But it's like, I don't think we do. I think that there can be two different ways to look at it. And a strong, strong negative DMI focus, you know, low dry matter intake focus, could be a cow-calf yearling extensive, you know, like grazing program. And then you can still kind of have an RADG, RFI, you know, somewhat approach if you're in a more traditional push them harder type environment. But because, yeah, I think the same thing. I don't know that we've seen gains, you know, necessarily from like yearling programs to the same degree as we've seen gains in feed yard increases. And it's like, okay, why would we? Did we focus on that? Or did we like look at all of our growth as a measurement of yearling weight? And so it was all about faster maturing, faster growing animals, instead of, you know, the system that ultimately I think is enormously profitable just by putting them out in grass and forage and running yearlings. But we just haven't selected for those kind of animals in a mass way.
Right. Right.
Can you alluded to your role on the marketing side and then your brother's role on more of the farming operations side. Can you talk through just, you know, your yearly plan as far as putting up feed and how you guys work together, and then how you're planning out your grazing strategies moving forward with calving later now and getting things out on stocks longer, and how that rolls out through the year?
Sure. Yeah, it's a work in progress. Traditionally, came into the fall and decided how many acres of silage to chop. And the hay production was all relatively the same, because it's the same hay acres that we've always had. And so now moving to more of a more grazing dominant production system, it's changed things considerably, you know. And so we're having to plan much farther in advance, because if you want to calve on rye pasture, that's not something that you can decide in January.
In the spring, yeah.
And so we really, I don't know if we've worked out a perfect system yet, but it's really just been about constant communication and talking ahead and what we would like to do and what's possible, and then going back and scratching out some numbers and figuring out if that's something that makes sense, or if that's if there's another option. We calved on rye last year. I really liked it. It was a way to get cows onto green grass before before our native pastures were ready to go. But then there's some additional challenges after that with terminating the rye crop and planting beans into it, and I'm not sure what necessarily the effect on our bean crop was. Yields were lower, but you'd also have to, think that there's some soil health advantages as well with that. And then, yeah, crop aftermath's been the biggest thing. You know, we're fortunate to have quite a few acres of crop aftermath at our disposal that are all, you know, contiguous to our pasture ground. And so we can trail cows anywhere we need to go to crop aftermath. Historically, that's always been corn stalks. But this last year, we grew quite a bit of Milo, and I really, really like the Milo stocks for grazing cows now, especially, you know, now in January where the snow's getting kind of deep. There's still quite a bit of feed available in those Milo stocks. And so I'd really like to continue to expand that and utilize more of the corn stocks in the fall and the spring. And, you know, rely more on those milos and standing covers during the winter for mm-hmm. grazing.
Yeah. Yeah, that stock is a lot more upright, you know, through the whole process than a cornfield, right? It's just easier for them to access it in deeper snow.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's a bit of a learning curve for our cows, too. You know, they were used to, you know, having a buffet every day. And now they've got to go out and hunters and gatherers and forage for their feed. And, you know, I think, you know, their ability to dig through that snow and get to the corn stalks is developing, but it's not something that just happens overnight. I think that's something that you have to gradually work into. I was listening to one of your podcast guests, I think it was Roy Thompson, who talked about what did he say? He said you have to earn the right to reduce inputs. And I really feel like that's definitely the case with you know, moving cows to a low input strategy. Is it not something that you can just flip a switch and do overnight? It's something that you have to change both from a management level and a genetic perspective, and do it gradually to, you know, adapt those cows to a different production system. Yeah. So yeah, right now we're relying on Milo stocks during the winter time, but yeah, I'm not afraid to push cows a little bit and get them to graze through the snow and go after some of those corn stalks. But yeah, the Milo has been very nice to run on in the wintertime.
What about as far as developing these bulls now, right? So you're selling them as an aged bull that next year. Talk about the development of them as far as keeping them grazing a little bit later, keeping them longer, trying to add value because they're older. Some of the advantages of that to your purchasers?
So one of my big responsibilities is customer service that goes along with our bull sales. And when you're selling yearling bulls that, you know, have been fed pretty hard and are, you know, pretty fat come turnout time and, you know, may or may not have the best foot quality, you know, you end up getting, you know, some issues that you have to address either through, you know, replacing bulls or, you know, credits and things like that. And I really want to get to a point where, you know, we sell bulls and they go out and do their jobs and I don't ever have to worry about, handling, you know, a credit anymore. And the older age bulls, I mean, by the time we sell them, they've pretty much jumped over every hurdle that we've put in front of them. And we have very, very few issues with, you know, the older bulls when we sell them. I think they're just, they're developed the right way. Anything that has fallen out is gone by the time we market them. And it makes my life a lot easier because, yeah, in order to sell as many bulls as we'd like, it requires a lot of customer service. And I've got a lot of other things going on, day-to-day management and the more I can reduce that part of the business, the better. But yeah, we run those bulls out on pasture all summer. You know, this year I think it was until like the 1st of October that we got them in and started feeding them. If we move our sale up to more of a fall sale, like a November sale, we'll probably bring them in off grass a little earlier. But yeah, right now they're in a lot, and we'll get everything tested through the feed intake barn, and then you know in spring we'll start transitioning to some crop aftermath and then native pasture after that until you know probably middle of August, and then we'll start bringing them in and developing them for a November sale.
Yeah. So, and advantage you guys have is a big enough tract of land where you don't have to like, you know, pick a quarter of land that's got two neighboring cow herds next to it and take a pasture of bulls, right? Right. I imagine that would be a bit of a problem. You can kind of keep them isolated with some crop ground, you know, fences. You're probably pretty selective on which pastures are the bull pastures, I'm assuming.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah. There's a few pastures that we've got that, you know, are kind of designated as being bull pastures. And, yeah, we've not done as much work in some of those pastures, in terms of cross fencing and, you know, water infrastructure. And so that's where we go with them. And, you know, hopefully we'll get more intensive on their grazing, but right now it's more just a set stock situation. Mm-hmm. And then we focus on, you know, the cow herd and the stockers then for rotational grazing.
Rotation. Yeah. So you've made the transition over the last couple of years from calving in January, right? So calving these cows in January to calving these cows in the end of May. So you were entering the third trimester there about the time you were going to corn stocks and going to, you know, the first time that the cheap, you know, kind of moderately lower quality feed became available, you were already in the third trimester. Were you able to take advantage of even crop aftermath in the way that you should have with calving that early, or were you having to start feeding them too early?
Yeah, we would always start feeding about December 1st. And so
yeah.
We would maybe get, you know, 30 days if we were lucky on stocks. Yeah. And, you know, never really had any water infrastructure. And so it was basically old stock dams, things like that. Mm-hmm. And so then, yeah, after the 1st of December, it was usually too cold and dams started freezing up and we got tired of chopping ice. And so we'd bring them in and start feeding them. And so that's one of our big projects right now. We partnered with DU and their RCCP, RCPP program. Yep. To install perimeter fence and water infrastructure on quite a bit of crop ground. And so over the next 5 years, we'll put in 20 miles of perimeter fence and 8 miles of water line to better take advantage of that that crop aftermath. Because that's really been one of the other issues, too, is fencing. I'm tired of poly fence in wintertime.
Yeah. Once you know you're going to go into that system, I mean, and you know you can get by with a three barb fence, you know what I mean? It's not so bad to maintain those. It's not the same as a pasture fence. So,
yeah.
Great. But yeah, what you've been able to, as you're talking about alternative forage and stuff, you've got a lot more different options, even for the stored feed that you are putting up, right? You don't need to be hitting them with corn silage, you know, for 4 or 5 months, you've got a lot of different opportunities. And I know we've kind of explored those, you know, Nate and, you know, and I and you and Justin, we've all, you know, been in a group talking a little bit about, you know, different perennial options, different, you know, annual forage options and things like that. So you have a lot more options.
Right.
You don't need the energy coming from corn silage like you used to.
Right. Yeah. And really, you know, our big push is to get away from, you know, running implement in front of the cows to, you know, harvest and store all that feed. I mean, we really want the cows to be doing more of the work and, you know, harvesting that forge themselves instead of us doing it for them. And so, yeah, that's one of the great things about this too, is it, you know, reduces overhead, reduces labor, and allows us to employ a more diverse crop rotation. And I think we're just scratching the surface of what's possible. These systems, I mean, they take a long time to adjust and change. You know, we've been doing the same thing the same way for the last 30 some years. And it's been really nice to lessen the, you know, labor, and, you know, the stress of calving in the wintertime and trying to get everything fed in the wintertime. But it's also at the same time, the system has become much more complex and much more dynamic. And it's got its own set of challenges. But I'm excited to, get further down that path and see what's possible. And you guys have been a great asset in, helping us with that change. And I think there's going to be some cool things happening.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it allows you to take advantage of so many different things with the integration of the farming systems, your hunting lodge and your need for habitat acres, from that standpoint, that revenue source, that value proposition. You've got a lot of different options for edge of field practices as potential forage sources, either as hay or for grazing, diverse crop types, diverse alternative forages. So it's been fun getting to banter around with a lot of different types of ideas with your operation over the years.
I think it's funny to think about how a more dynamic system actually gives you less control, but it takes more management, right? Like you have to think way more forward than what you were, but in the system that you were in, you controlled a lot of things, especially, you controlled the harvest schedule more, the feeding schedule. You were able to have your finger on all those things. And so letting go of some of that and just you talked about just letting the cows go work actually takes a bit more management because you got to plan so much more too.
Yeah. So one of our last conversations too, it's easier to say, okay, all the cows are confined. They're all right here. We just have to feed them. All it's going to take is money and fuel and time. So we can spend, someone's job for 7 or 8 hours is just to feed cows. It takes all day long. But then it's like, okay, if they're spread out, and it's, what if a storm comes? Like, what if it took 7 or 8 hours to get around chopping all the dugout, that check and fence and everything? It's like, well, we commit that. We're more comfortable committing to it every single day, right? And have it known than we are like, okay, we're down to 1 or 2 hours a day in labor. But what happens if something happens? It could take all day, right?
Right.
But it's easier for us to conceptualize it when we, plan for it. But
yeah.
Yeah, and the cost savings too. I mean, I think that's the big thing. And I'd like to, see that more in our industries where we become more focused on costs instead of, additional revenue. I think that's the way to be more profitable in our industry. It's not, selling a calf in the fall that's, 20 or 30 pounds heavier than our neighbors or, maybe getting a premium on your, fat cattle for some additional carcass. I think it's really, being able to run more cows on your ranch and being able to increase your weaning percentages and reduce your cow costs. Those are the things. And it's not necessarily as sexy as, the additional revenue, but I think at the end of the day, that's really what's going to add the most to our producer's profitability.
Yeah. Very good.
All right. So now I alluded to this at the beginning of the podcast. We got to do our graze it, harvest it, rent it out game. And this one fits good because it's perfect for somebody in central South Dakota running cows. He came in from our good friend Trent Kubik in Hamble, South Dakota.
Nice.
And so Trent sent this in, emailed it in, all right? So he said, all right, all your fields are the same size, and it's May 15th. and you have to choose to graze one, harvest one, and just rent the one out. You don't want to deal with it, okay? And harvest, it means you could chop it, you could hay it, and then obviously grazing, you got to graze it. Okay, so you have an unharvested cornfield from last year. You've got a straight stand of smooth brome. And you've got a 27-year-old alfalfa stand. Which one will you graze? Which one will you harvest? And which one are you just going to rent out?
How are you going to harvest that corn? Like, huh? I mean, can you combine it? Can we combine the corn in this scenario?
Let's say you cannot combine anything. You have to chop or hay it.
Okay. Okay.
That's tough.
Okay, I think I got it. I think I got it. I'll let AJ go first. The guest gets to go first.
Okay.
Otherwise, I just like get in there and start telling everybody what I think before I get your perspective.
Is none of the above an answer? Can I?
Usually the rent it is kind of like your punt it. Like, that's like, let somebody else from. I always take rent it as revenue stream, you know, like I always try to capitalize on it. Yeah, I usually do. But some people will be like, I'm just going to rent that out. I don't care what I get for it. I just don't want to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I guess what I would do is it's May 15th and it's 27-year-old alfalfa stand. So there's really not a whole lot out there, is there?
Nope.
Okay. Well, I guess I'm going to graze the unharvested cornfield. I would rent out the alfalfa and harvest the smooth brome.
Okay.
Makes sense.
On May 15th?
Can you what?
Do you have to harvest it on May 15th?
Yeah. I don't know. Like, we make up whatever rules we want. But yes, that's what we're doing. Yep.
Okay.
I think so.
There's not going to be anything to harvest in any three of those, though.
Yeah, I think your brome grass probably has more forage than what the old alfalfa stand has, though.
Yeah, I'm going to graze that. So, I'm going to graze the brome. In my part of the world, that brome, that's going to be, well, and transfer from winter, too. They warm up like 2 months earlier than we do, you know, down there. So there's that. But anyway, 15th of May, I can usually go to grass 15th of May on brome. So I'm going to graze that. I'm going to harvest, and I haven't figured out how to do this yet, but somehow I'm going to like do some kind of harvest that's allowable as forage. Like, I don't know if I'm going to like run it through and like dry chop it, you know what I mean? Like earlage, but like with dry ears or something. I don't know how any of this is going to work, but somehow I'm going to get that corn in a pile somewhere according to the forage rules of graze it, you know, harvest it, rent it. To get that done. I don't know how exactly I'm going to do it.
Why couldn't you just – what do you think the moisture would be if you baled it?
Well, I just think you'd lose so many ears. At that point, you're just going to be making a mess of the ears, and you're just going to be littered. Like the whole ground is going to be yellow because you're going to lose it all off the cob. It's going to shatter. I just don't think you can get into a bale. Yeah, I don't think you can get into a bale at all. How would you lay it down? How are you lay it down?
Swather.
Swather, you think?
I don't know.
I mean, they're going to shatter, but then you're going to rake them up.
Yeah, but a rake does. I don't know. I just think it's going to be the whole ground is going to be yellow. That's my prediction. The whole ground is going to be yellow unless you figure out a way to snap those ears off and run it through something else.
So you're going to come in and chop it.
Yeah. Right. I bet they'll probably just chop it. And then you'll have like a dry fluff. It's going to be a mess, but like it'll be mostly corn.
It would be like a corn. It'd be like a combination of earlidge mixed with ground corn stalks.
Yeah. Very finely ground corn stalks. Cool. Okay, we'll figure that out. And then I'm going to rent out. What's that?
That's like 10% moisture.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Right. Well, okay. Well, that's what you got to do, right? There's not always good options. You just got to do something. You got to keep one day at a time, one foot in front of the other. We're going to figure out how to do this. Okay. And then I'm going to rent out the alfalfa field. For what? I don't know. But like, we'll get something for it. This will be my few times where I rent something out that I'm not sure if I'm going to get enough value for it.
Yeah, that one's hard because there's nothing to do with it on May 15th. So it is kind of your punt, though. So I like you grazing that corn, especially if you're going there. You're probably going to calve on it then. Let's say you're calving in May. You're going to calve on the standing corn stalks. If you did a little bit of fencing and managed it, that's not so bad to do. At least you're utilizing it all that way.
Chip graze it.
Actually, you should run your bulls out there then.
Yeah. TMR.
Yep. Throw some calves out there.
All right. That sounds good. Well, AJ, this is your chance. You got to let us know about this bull sale coming up. What's the story with that?
Yeah. President's Day, February 19th at the ranch. Selling a couple hundred bulls. Last year of yearling bulls. So, it's about 50-50 yearling bulls and coming twos.
Coming twos.
The yearling bulls are all either ET bulls or out of first calf heifers. So kind of interesting, but that's just how it worked out as we moved everything over and tried to keep bull inventories the same. And then, then we'll have another sale this fall that will be all 18-month-old bulls. But, come on out. We cook a steak and trying to have a good time. Hopefully the weather's decent. Cross your fingers.
It's a good meal. It's awesome. It's always a very good meal. Good pies afterwards, two good desserts. It's a top-notch bull sale meal. February 19th.
That's awesome.
All roads lead to Highmark. Lee Heights.
That's
greater
right.
Area. Yeah. All right, perfect. AJ, thanks so much for the conversation.
Thanks,
guys. Appreciate
right.
it. Thanks,
Jordan. Thanks for listening. Oh, and hey, listeners, can't forget, if you've got to graze it, harvest it, rent it out, they've got to email it in, rootsandruminants@gmail.com. So thanks all for right. listening. Tune in another couple of weeks. We'll get you another episode.
Well, we hope you enjoyed another episode of the Roots and Ruminants podcast. Let us know what you thought of it. You can follow us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, all those social media things. And, if you ever have any questions, just give us a call. We've got a toll-free number here at 888-498-7333. Be glad to hear from you. Thank you.